Hi, everyone. Welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Nick Rohrkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And today we're bringing you a special episode all about Dune Part 2. This came out a few weeks ago, and since it was during the award season, we just wanted to give it a little bit of time, also because of how adventurous of an epic it is. And we needed to break down Denis Villeneuve's continuation of the story, what's going to happen after this, and everything new he brought us in this second part to that first novel. So I'm excited to break it down and talk about what we liked or what we didn't like. And obviously at the end, bringing Smasher Pass Part 2 of the Dune universe.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about Dune Part 2. It's funny because I feel like we really wanted to talk about it during the Oscar season. That was the funny part about this movie coming out early March, was that it was right when we were in the thick of everything. We're like, no, we need to wait a little bit. Let's finish out our season as is. But we also couldn't save it for next season. Yeah, this felt like the perfect opportunity for a little bonus episode, especially since Denis Villeneuve is one of our Siskel and Ebert directors, meaning you love him and I tend to approach his movies with caution, as they do not always work for me. But I think this film was really eagerly anticipated, especially by both of us, because we read the book. And I know for me, I just wanted to see how he tackled the political themes, the discussions of religious fanaticism that are found in that part in the book that were missing from part one, as he really focused on the exposition and the world building. So yeah, I think this will be a good conversation.
Well, I guess to start just very briefly or generally, where does this sit for you in Villeneuve's filmography now?
I actually think it's number two after Blade Runner 2049. I found this to be a significant improvement over part one.
Not even Arrival. I'm surprised.
Arrival, I have a really tricky relationship with, as in I've never rewatched it because it came out right around the 2016 election. And I think I've just subconsciously never returned to it. So maybe I'll rewatch it and we'll rank it higher. But right now, I think it's my number two.
Okay. I mean, that's higher than I thought it would be. So yeah, let's go back, introduce the film, and then we can get into details. So the description of part two: Paul Atreides unites with Chani and the Fremen while seeking revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family. Facing a choice between the love of his life and the fate of the universe, he must prevent a terrible future only he can foresee. Directed by Denis Villeneuve, it stars Timothée Chalamet, Zendaya, Austin Butler, Rebecca Ferguson, Javier Bardem, Florence Pugh, Lea Seydoux, Christopher Walken, Charlotte Rampling, and more. A lot of those were mainstays from part one. So you mentioned that part one set up a lot of the exposition, and part two is getting into the nitty-gritty, the political themes, making this world way more complex than what we saw in part one. And I think that's what makes this such, I would say, a bigger blockbuster, a more epic film that has people comparing it to The Empire Strikes Back, or Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. These humongous films that tackle these supposedly unadaptable source materials. And that is what people expected with this, especially after David Lynch's version, or that studio's version of the movie. So I think what we got is really what we wanted to see. Huge action sequences, but still these incredible close-ups of the characters, and actually some decent character development that maybe we didn't even see in part one.
I'll get there.
Maybe with certain characters over others. But let's start talking about maybe what we did like or didn't like, and then we can get into scenes from there. So whichever you'd like to start with, the good or the bad.
Yeah. Well, first I want to ask you, because you are the Villeneuve expert, the Villeneuve head of the pod, where does it sit for you? Because you love a lot of his films, whereas I truly only love one of his films. So it's a little different for me. But for you, like being a big fan and loving part one, whereas I was a bit colder on part one, I think I want to hear from you first on that.
I've been so conflicted with this now that I've seen it twice, because I've seen part one so many times. And I think when that came out, the settings I and we saw that in were just so memorable. They blew me away. The sound blew me away. These images. And I've seen that at least 5 times now. And I think there were parts from that first installment that I really connected with more than certain aspects here. But I think the visual acuity and a lot of the specifics and details that they put to work here are way better than part one. So I'm kind of conflicted in saying where it sits. I would say maybe about the middle of his filmography.
Okay.
But it's also the biggest undertaking he's had in movie going, I think, throughout his whole career.
Yeah, it's difficult because I think there are some things in this film that are better than anything he's done before. And yet he still falls into some of the pitfalls that I think he falls into in every film, which really for me are choices around character development. And here, I think we just have so many characters that what's strange to me is that part one and my issues with part one, it's so funny. I went back and listened to our episode on part one from 2 years ago, mm-hmm. 2.5 years ago at this point. And it's so funny because I start the episode by saying, you know, people are comparing this to Lawrence of Arabia and to 2001 A Space Odyssey. Good for them. It's not quite that. And that's kind of what's happening, I think, with this one. But my biggest thing from that really was that there was way too much focus being placed on world building and exposition, getting us ready for part two. But now that we have part two, I don't know entirely if the division between the two movies worked. That's where I'm really stuck right now, because part one, to me, it's very dense. It's a lot of information. I don't think it's structured in a way that has a lot of verve and punch to it that I'm looking for from a sci-fi action movie. And it just fell flat because there weren't characters that I cared about except for Lady Jessica, who, let me tell you, in this movie, again, greatest character for me. Mm-hmm. So I think I was building up, like, okay, if part one is really doing all of this groundwork to set up part two really needs to be expertly made. And on a technical level, again, I think we're close to that. I think especially with the costume design, the production design, the makeup, those characters look fantastic. But this movie, to me, has almost the opposite problem that part one does, which is that it's almost 3 hours, but I felt like I needed another hour of it.
To understand it, or that you were so into it you wanted more of the world?
Both. I think because the way that he sets it up is very Game of Thrones-like to me, where you're going from different set piece to different set piece and you're meeting all of these different characters. So you naturally are going to have families and storylines that you get more attached to than others. And I felt like because there were so many introductions that needed to be made, so many plot lines that were being developed, I felt that some of them ended up being underbaked because we had to get to so much in part two. So I think I needed it to be a bit more stretched out to really feel from these characters the things that I felt when I was reading the book.
I think that's something Villeneuve and co-writer John Spates did well here, is that there's so much in the book, especially in that second part, that they took out so many aspects, and we can talk about differences and what we think about that in a little bit. But I think in refocusing the second part on certain actions that happen and not diving too deep, I probably said the same thing in part one, that I love the visual so much that, you know, going deep into these characters was almost secondary.
You're just like Villeneuve. This is why he's the director for you, because that I think that's how he thinks too. And that's like that line that he said, I don't care about dialogue, effectively. Cinema is visual.
Yeah, and that's very much what this is. But I think separately from that, not only in editing down the source material, it's where does this go after the fact? Not that we're getting all 6 books turned into movies. I mean, I hope not. It's just so much material. It's like Avatar 7. We're going to have like Dune 6 out there.
These do make more sense than either Avatar.
Right. I mean, there's a basis that Frank Herbert made with all of this, and I think his mind is just genius, but Denis is now shaping his version of this story to match what is to come. And I applaud him for that, even though it was also why I was a little confused or lower on the film the first time I saw it than I expected to be because it was different than what I had read and what I had wanted to see on screen. So I think there's a lot going into this, and that's the hard part. And just like any movie, you can't appease everyone. Not everyone's going to love it. But I definitely agree that parts are not perfect, but there are other parts that are. So I kind of balance them out.
Yeah. And there were some parts of this movie, and we can get into those, where I just thought to myself, oh, I am watching something I've never seen before. Or like, this is something I'm going to remember for a very long time that I think future filmmakers will replicate to a lesser degree. Like, when I think of that sequence when we meet Fade Rotha in the black and white, like, I have goosebumps thinking about it just because we've seen so many sci-fi films, television series. We kind of know what to expect when we're venturing to, oh, like, this is, you know, this is the villain planet. This is where they live. What could this possibly look like? But what stood out to me in that was that when I first saw the trailer, I thought it was going to be a flashback. Because in the book, Fade Rotha is introduced very early. So I thought, like, is this going to be a flashback to an earlier sequence that we haven't seen before that would have existed sort of in the timeline of part one? But then when I realized, like, no, we're in the present. This is just how he's choosing to introduce us to this character in this, like, gladiator-style sequence, I was pretty struck by it. And it looked real. And that seems so, like, silly and cliche to say, oh, something looks real in front of you. But this looked tactile. This looked like a world I could have stepped right into. But at the same time, it felt so otherworldly in that color bleed, the transitions that they use, and the way that it's very difficult to explain. But there isn't, for me, in the writing, unfortunately, there's not a lot of nuance in the Harkonnens. To allow us to really see the complexity of this group as a threat, especially with the reveal of Lady Jessica's bloodline. Like, I wanted that to be a bit more punctuated, I would say, in the script. We have to, I think, understand them and why they're so in opposition to each other. I think we get that in the book, but I don't see that so much in the movie. But I think that this sequence in particular really helped in showing the evil nature of Fade Rotha, and it also perfectly gave us a little bit more information on the Bene Gesserit as this breeding program, and getting to meet Lady Margot as she's holding up those little glasses, A+. So that was definitely one of my favorite scenes in the movie, and one that I'll really remember when I think back on it.
The characters here that I have issue with are Raban, played by Dave Bautista, who I feel like is always out of 10, and it just immediately puts me off. He's just screaming at everybody the whole time. It's like, okay, we get it. Calm down.
It's like Brendan Fraser in Killers of the Flower Moon.
And Margot, who you mentioned, Lea Seydoux, who is married to Count Fenring, and I feel like that whole character and relationship or family was totally cut. And I didn't remember any of that from the book. I think she comes back in Messiah. But again, yeah, the way they introduced her, I was like, why is she here? And realizing she's married, like, she's hitting on Fade or trying to get into his mind. And then bringing that back to the Bene Gesserit. It was maybe a little bit too much thinking going on compared to everything else that he had already done for us. And then we have Princess Irulan, played by Florence Pugh, who I feel like really is there for the audience because she's confused and maybe we are a little bit too in reintroducing ourselves into this world. And if you read the book, like, you know what's happening and why she's there. I felt like when I read it that she was a completely different character than who Florence played her as. But I kind of liked that more. How did you feel about her?
The thing about the Irulan character, I agree with you. Not what I expected in the book. Very different, but that's okay. I still think I liked Florence Pugh here, even though I really did find this character to be pretty underwritten. I think the best way that I can describe how I feel about this character is for someone like Irulan, I don't know much about her from the movie. There's very little I know, but I'm obsessed with that scroll that they use to get the messages. And I just think to myself, okay, so I think Denis Villeneuve is much more interested in those sorts of little details, right? Getting that accuracy of specific tasks or what specific props will look like or what they would be wearing. I think he's very interested in that and in how the world works and the machinations. But as far as who this character is or how this character is developed, I didn't really feel much from her. And what's interesting is that she has the opening voiceover here. She's kind of setting the scene for us. We don't get a recap of part one or anything like that, but she is opening up the world of Dune part two before we go right back to Paul and Chani and Jessica and the Fremen. And it's a very similar role that Zendaya had as Chani in part one. And what Villeneuve said for part one was, you know, don't worry, she's going to get a bigger role in the next movie. And I sort of think that's what he's doing with Florence Pugh here, is he's saying, don't worry, she's going to have a bigger part in the next movie. Because Messiah has already been teased, and obviously, you know, it's coming thanks to that ending and everything else we've heard so far. But yeah, I think she's just being set up for a bigger role later on. She's the Emperor's daughter. She's, you know, working alongside the Bene Gesserit. She ends up marrying Paul in a political marriage. Like, those are all things that I think we just needed a little bit more on in order to understand why this alliance had to happen, but also why everything that happened with Paul and Chani was so painful. And we'll definitely want to talk about them too. And I did feel, I think, grounded when she was on screen. Like, I did feel like I was in good hands and I was going to learn more information about where we were going next. But this is what I described on the first episode. Reading the book is a double-edged sword because you have the additional information, which makes everything easier because you can fill in those gaps that might be there. But at the same time, you also know what else is missing and you want to bring that into the world in some way.
I think the advantage of having Florence Pugh is that she did do more for her character here than Zendaya did in part one. And even if they weren't given much, either of them, I think she did more with it in making us understand maybe who she was or her connection to her father, the Emperor, or how she felt about different characters, including the Bene Gesserit or Paul, and maybe where we would be led with the next film. And I will say that the first scene of Dune Messiah is very shocking. But again, I think that's where Villeneuve is leading us into of now we're 12 years down the road looking at where is Paul, where is the Muad'Dib? And I think that time gap compares to the 2-year time gap that we had in part two that he cut out. One of those big things in there is that there were children between Paul and Chani, and then Lady Jessica's child, Paul's sister, is born and they actually fight in battles. But taking that time gap out.
Sorry, I'm laughing. It's just like.
No, I know. I think that was a good thing because having children fight in battle is just weird in itself. And like we said multiple times, Denis is grounding this world in reality, or he's creating this photorealistic world, and that just doesn't fit in there. But this 2-year time gap that he cut out, I think, works. And also dividing part one and part two, because when we are reunited with the Fremen and Paul and Jessica, it seems like they're more integrated into their society. They're not necessarily accepted at their headquarters, but we feel as viewers almost that Paul and Jessica have become more like the Fremen and they understand Arrakis a bit more now.
Yeah, I think that the timing in the movie is interesting because when I watched it, I really did think like it's picking up exactly where part one leaves off. Because one of my criticisms with part one was that it didn't feel like a full movie. And I thought, okay, well, once I get part two, I will see this as a full movie and that it just kind of like continues exactly where it leaves off. But I liked the opening of how the Fremen don't entirely, you know, trust them yet. They don't really know what to do with them, especially because Jessica is Bene Gesserit. And, you know, Paul has effectively also just killed one of their own. And I think that opening battle that we get with the Fremen and the Harkonnens, that had some of the best like sci-fi filmmaking in the movie. When the Harkonnens are levitating,
Kisardikar,
practically,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is so amazing. But yeah, that was when I first thought, okay, I understand why people are hyping this up so much. It was just one of those visuals that does make this movie really stand out.
Well, you see them running and you don't expect them to start flying. And then he
mm-hmm.
cuts to this other view and watching them, my jaw was on the floor. And I think at this moment on my second watch, I mean, I had known other incredible shots were coming, but I started keeping a tally of the perfect shots from the movie that I really liked. And this was the first one, for sure. I think it sets up the characters as well. I can't remember if it was before or after the battle, but we do get this shot of the embryo. And I think that was the other opening or early shot that I was like, uh-oh, what are we doing? And or comparing the film to 2001 again. So that was maybe a Villeneuve tactic here. But it does get us thinking about the actual baby in the film, Lady Jessica's child, Alia, who does speak to her and Paul and have this important relationship that we don't get to see from the book, but still plays somewhat of a role in a shocking cameo later on as well.
I loved the talking fetus. It was so weird. And one of my favorite things about Herbert's novel is its strangeness. Like, these characters are really weird. The rules of the world are different. And it's why so many other sci-fi properties have copied off of Dune or lifted from Dune. It's that weirdness and how that infuses with the darkness in the material as well. And I felt like this interpretation of Alia was really interesting. It made a lot of sense, and it saved us from having a toddler go into battle, which I think he could have done it, but I do think this was a smart choice to not, because having Lady Jessica be pregnant as she becomes the Reverend Mother and drinks the water of life, it escalates her pregnancy, because I think pregnant women, we hear about, you know, an intuitive connection that they have through pregnancy sometimes, especially as they get closer to delivery, like when a baby kicks or just certain signs and connections that they have before delivery. And I think that this just takes that up a notch and makes it so spooky and weird. And another threat really to Paul. You see Alia and Jessica as one entity before you know her later on. And we do, yeah, only meet her in cameo in this, but I think it's a really interesting choice and one that I did really like. I think also another part of it that was difficult for me was that it was the passage of time, because with pregnancy, you know, we're used to, I think, that being a marker of how much time has passed. And because we don't meet Alia as a baby or, you know, see her fighting in battle, or spoilers are thrown around here, killing the Baron, then it feels in the movie like only 9 months have passed from the start of the story to the end. And that's a very short amount of time for the events of this film to unfold. So I think that was the only detriment really to his decision to not have her have Alia and to have her involved in everything, because you have to, and I think in the book you understand this, you have to feel the weight of that passage of time. Mm-hmm. And here it feels, I think, a bit more rushed.
I agree, because when Jessica and Paul are talking and saying they have to sway the non-believers, and when the Fremen and the Harkonnen speak of the amount of Fremens on the planet, they say there are millions in the south. So I think that does take more than just 8 months to accomplish. But I think that passage of time for me was shown somewhat by the pacing of the film and in just placing these events so separately from one another that it allowed Paul to at least feel like he had matured throughout that time, even though he cut that timing out.
I have to say, I thought Timothée Chalamet was excellent in this movie. This is, I think, my second favorite performance of his after Call Me By Your Name. I was really impressed with his ability to make that jump And that wasn't something that I saw coming. I was a bit skeptical of that, but I think you really do believe in his confidence and in how we see that growth from part one to part two. And I think he really does channel that type of anti-hero character that we've seen across films and literature. And we see here, I think, these outlines of a transition narrative that I think maybe by another writer that was a bit more concerned with character development, I think it could have been even richer. But I think that with the material he was given, I think Timothée Chalamet did a great job.
Yeah, I feel like he did transform at least enough to make us see him as a leader going into that final speech when he has to rally everybody. Even his closest friends are scared that he couldn't do it. And he definitely does. Something else from the book that they, I don't think, do enough here, but they try to, is that he has these visions constantly of starting this war, causing so many murders to happen, and him trying to do what he can to prevent that. And once he drinks the water of life and becomes the Kwisatz Haderach, he finally sees the way where he wins and survives. And to me, that didn't feel as evil as maybe I thought it would be, or they didn't place enough emphasis on the narrow way through being that so many people would still be murdered along the way in order for him to survive. I think that was a little disconnect there between the book and the film, that honestly, I didn't see him as that evil at the end of the movie. But I think he is, and that's why where the story goes is in large part due to that fact.
A hard thing also is that, and this is just another thing with Villeneuve that I have trouble with, is that there just isn't enough care placed on character development for you to feel the things that you are, I think, supposed to feel from the book. And a difficulty for me with Chani was that she's all alone in her refusal, really, to join the other Fremen in saying that Paul is the chosen one. That to me was a little bit too convenient, maybe, in terms of storyline, like to distinguish her. But also, it just, for me, it didn't make sense. Like, I wanted her to have at least a few other Fremen on her side, if that makes sense. Because I think by the end, Chani is angry at Paul for so many things. Like, it isn't just that he's choosing Irulan. It's for many deeper reasons that she's seen this and that this is going to threaten her people. And that's where the anger comes from. But I think we should feel that more deeply by the time the film ends.
Especially because she was really the only one who was trusting in him in the beginning in order to have this relationship. And she is who brought him into the Fremen. And then in this movie, it's also a little caricaturish of Stilgar, Javier Bardem's character, of being the comedic character, the centerpiece for the religious themes of the movie, and how he really gets everybody else to follow Paul. And then in the very end, and that's another big change, is that, yeah, Chani leaves. Even though in the book, she stayed, she was his concubine, and he really only loved her, even though he was married to Irulan for the purpose of being the next emperor. I think a line that I like, there were a lot of parallels from part one to part two, and also in part two alone, early on in the film when they have this like romantic montage, maybe a little cheesy, but he says that he would love her as long as I breathe. And then at the final moment, after he fights Fade, he goes up to Chani, fully knowing what he's about to do and hoping that she's going to trust him. And he says, I want you to know I will love you as long as I breathe. So he's repeating that again, but she doesn't fully believe in him anymore.
Yeah. I do have a question. Did you find like their romance believable? Is this a convincing relationship? Because this is a core part of the beginning stretch of the film when we see Chani and Paul together. It's, I think, supposed to be this romance or this love story, but I felt like I just wanted a little bit more from that. What did you think?
They felt like two teenagers, like high school students in their first relationship. Like, it never felt like true love to me. And I think that's what it was lacking, because at the end, I felt like it was more of Chani whining and upset than it being this big heartbreaking story between them two.
You really, I think, are supposed to feel that pain. Like you mentioned, she becomes Paul's concubine. And in the movie, I don't think he necessarily like spends enough time building that up. I think I feel more for Chani that she's alone, that she's the only one who can see this, and that everyone is listening to Stilgar and they're following Lady Jessica and believing her. And she's sort of on this island by herself. And that to me was like why I felt so badly for her. But her relationship with Paul was a bit underdeveloped, I think, in what I would have liked to have seen from it.
So what about other favorite scenes or moments or performances that you'd want to talk about?
We have to talk about Rebecca Ferguson as Lady Jessica. I think she really picks up on the work that she started in part one, because I think that she makes Lady Jessica such a compelling character. You also feel the strength in her relationship with Paul there, and here the cracks start to form, but you also, I think, start to understand them as a pair, why they're threatening to each other, but also why they work together, I think, in part one too. So I really love what she did with the character. I thought she was such like a scary Cersei Lannister type of villainess. And I think that she was the character who I was paying attention the most to in terms of those themes of religious fanaticism, and how she was the one who wanted people to follow Paul, and that she really was committed to him. And in doing what she thought was the best thing for him, even if it was the most dangerous thing to everyone else. And those were the themes I really paid attention to and latched onto in the book. And I was glad to see them here. And I thought she just did such a great job with them. She was so scary in this movie, I thought.
Rebecca's also had the best press tour with this movie.
Oh my God, yeah.
She's funny. She's charming. She also just doesn't care. And, you know, she goes into the interviews talking about whatever. But she's also mentioned jokingly that Dainese kept putting veils on her and she was pregnant. She had to lug that prosthetic around on set the whole time. And she felt like she was seeing this world in such a different way because she was covered the entire time. And to the viewer, it's spectacular. You know, she's transforming, but she's also beautiful with all of these costumes on her. But I think that's interesting in how it makes us see the character, because it almost stifles her to a point that she really has to rely on those few scenes that she has. One with Stilgar, when they're looking at all of the water, I think that's really important. And then two, when she does transform and become the Reverend Mother and that power that she holds. And I think that was my favorite of her, is kind of like Paul and when he drinks the water of life and how he now is able to command this audience. She felt so much more powerful and evil in her own right too. I think some of that is in the camera and in how she says to Paul, like, we have to convert the non-believers and we have to turn them into followers. I think there is a little bit of evil in there, but it's her cadence and how she presents herself as an actress, in that being pregnant or wearing this prosthetic or wearing all these clothes didn't really inhibit her from being who she saw her character of being. And I think that was the most impressive to me.
My other favorite scene, I would say, one I'm going to get to in Smash or Pass for sure, but Paul on the sandworm. I thought that that was really exciting in one of those action sequences where I was kind of gripping the edge of my seat.
Well, I think that's the big moment from the book that you really want to see, and I was kind of scared of, is how are they going to do this? And, you know, how will the worm even look? What are these textures? Because I think that's what Villeneuve relies on so much, is visuals, but it's the air, the sand. How does it feel? Like when we mentioned Lawrence of Arabia, you know, it just feels hot when you're watching that movie. And he really needed to make this climate of Arrakis feel that way as well. So, you know, when we're on the worm, it looks like he's going 100 miles an hour, but he's able to control it. And even the lead up to that in seeing the worm coming, making sure the sand vibrating and exploding looks real. And that's really where I think this movie doesn't mess around, because a lot of it was done practically and it looks photorealistic. And if it didn't, I don't think we'd be talking about this movie right now.
I also thought just everything with the worms was great. Specifically, the scene also with how you draw the water of life from a worm. Those are the things that always make me think of Villeneuve as more of a scientist than an artist a bit, because I think he's so interested in process. And, you know, the things that, you know, I maybe want to see in a film that he doesn't go into, like character development as much, he does incorporate really incredible visuals, I think, attached to process. And this was one of them where I thought, oh, I'm so glad he put that in here, because it is just such a cool detail from the book.
That was one thing I completely forgot, is that they have these little baby worms. And It was just so cool in such a twisted way to see them drown the worm. And also in just how they talk about and use water in the film. Differently here than in the first one, they have these devices that suck all the water out of the people when they die. And we see it early on, and it just like suffocates the body. And it made me feel so uncomfortable. But I think those tactics and making everything feel tactile was really cool in this version, and particularly with that scene.
For all of the complaints I had about the ending of part one, I thought that the ending of part two was pretty phenomenal. I loved the lead up to this duel between Fade Ratha and Paul, and thought that it was staged and executed very beautifully. And I felt like it had a great ending, even though I think I was worried about it being this cliffhanger, not feeling like a full movie. I felt for me like this one succeeded much more in telling a complete story than part one did.
It did for me too. And something that made it that way for me is that even though he had to introduce us to all of these other aspects of the Dune world in this part two of that book, he was able to conclude them, or at least make them feel whole by the end. You know, the Emperor is dealt with. We finally see an end to the Baron. We have Paul becoming this Messiah that he was supposed to become in the first movie too. So there were a lot of closed ends that I was very happy with. But yeah, that final battle, just the entire end from when the Emperor comes in this like giant chrome Pokeball that was insane to look at, and just seeing the reflection of the world on it. Mm-hmm. And from that moment, these long shots and the backgrounds throughout the film, but seeing the battle sequences and the explosions, and then finally inside when we're with all of these main characters finally being together for the first time, and just seeing how small Christopher Walken made the Emperor feel and how weak of a person he was.
Yeah.
And then that final sequence with Fade and Paul, which in the book is another really important moment that I think they did well in making it however long it lasts. If it's like a 5-minute sequence, you can only watch two people fight for so long before getting bored.
I really did think Austin Butler was the perfect Fade Ratha, and that wasn't just evident in that first scene that I mentioned with him, where we get introduced to him in this gladiator style black and white scene. But here in this battle with Paul, I feel like that's also where the performance really shines. And my only thing really is I wish we would have gotten him in part one too. I wish that we had two movies with Butler as Fade Ratha, because I also think that in order for this fight to work in the best way possible, I think we need to understand a bit more of what these two sides are bringing into it. And I didn't feel that weight as much as I wanted to from it. As much as I liked the scene and I liked the ending, I wish that there was a bit more complexity in showing why they are so in opposition to each other, these two. But again, it's just a writing thing. I don't think this film is as concerned about the writing as it is about the visuals.
I think I see both sides with it, but I'm okay with it generally. It packs a lot more into the second part, but I think in expanding the world, you know, we were set up with really the necessities in part one of knowing what Caladan looked like, that they had water, that it was more earth-like than Arrakis, where they dream of water and laugh at the idea that it falls from the sky, like Chani says, or having oceans. I loved that shot of, you know, going over the sand and seeing the water. And that's when we get the Alia cameo. Mm-hmm. But here we actually go to Gedi Prime. We see other worlds. And it, I think, allowed the directors on the film, Greg Fraser with cinematography, and then Patrice Vermette with production design, including Susanna Sipos and Shane Vaux, the set decorators, all of those people to add to this world and make it feel more whole. Why I'm also okay with it here is that it makes a perfect supporting performance where he's in and out with like maybe 20, 30 minutes of screen time max, and that's it. And he gives it his all. Austin Butler, I'm talking about. His body is contorted in a way that we could have never expected, you know, having seen him in Elvis and just how evil he is. So to see him like this is such a shock, and it kind of makes me love that maybe he has potential for Oscar's attention later this year with supporting. Also, in related to other performances from the Oscars we've talked about before, I think this would very much align with some of those, and I would love to see it happen.
I would love to see Austin Butler nominated for this. I think it would be a great supporting actor nomination. Outside of Rebecca Ferguson, like, he does steal the show. Like, I think my interest in Rebecca Ferguson really is also because Lady Jessica is the most interesting character in the book to me. But as far as just scene-stealing performances, this kind of is Austin Butler's movie in many ways. I think he makes that character so dark and twisted and compelling. Whenever he wasn't on screen, I wanted him to be back. So I would love for that nomination to happen. But I think that this really, it does have a lot of Oscar potential, I think, especially in terms of the crafts. And we talked a little bit about that with on our episode last week with, you know, how would Dune shake up last year's Oscar race? I think it has already entered this year's Oscar race with, you know, production design, costume design, makeup and hairstyling. Those are the three for me that I love the most. The costume design by Jacqueline West, I loved it. And I think Donald Mowat's makeup work, former guest on Oscar Wilde, Donald Mowat, his makeup work I thought was really special, especially with the Harkonnens. And I mean, there's so many things here, visual effects. I'm not as high on the score. I wasn't also with the first one, but I think that here it feels a bit too similar for me, I think, to that. But I think this film's greatest flaw is its editing.
Really? What about it?
I think the pacing of the movie is pretty off, and it's a bit disorienting at times. So I think that that for me is the one where, that's not to say it won't get nominated. It just, for me, that was where the film lost me a little bit, because I think it has stretches that just go on and sort of feel like they amount to nothing, and then other parts of the film that really snap into place.
See, I see that as balancing itself out, where the action sequences are exquisitely edited and we feel all of that momentum. It does slow down. And I think that's where he tries to get into characters and more personal developments or relationships that are important to like who Paul is or how Paul and Chani feel about each other. But I think in terms of the runtime, I think it feels about right. Like, you go through all those modulations in order to get to this grand conclusion, especially in the beginning. You know, we start with the battle sequence, but things just build and build along the way. That I think the editing to me would seem like a good nomination. I do agree about score, and I would say screenplay. Those two for me would be on the chopping block for next year, but I do have 9 or 10 other nominations. Like you said, makeup and hairstyling, costumes. They should have won last time, and I think they have more reason to this time. Production design, absolutely. With the Gedi Prime sequence and designing those sets, the Gladiator arena, it was just like nothing we had seen from the Dune world before. So it really set itself apart. And then we talk about cinematography with Greg Fraser and how he used infrared cameras to get that appearance. And it really was like when you're indoors and you're in color and that slow fade to the infrared, the black and white, and seeing those ink blot fireworks, my mind was truly
ink
blown.
Blot. That's the word I was looking for. Oh my God. The ink blot fireworks. Yes.
It was almost like, yeah, ink was dropped into a vat of water and then they reversed that. Mm-hmm. And all of those visuals, just incredible. And then with the long hallway with Margot and Fade, and you see that light from the sun basically coming in, but they're in color.
That was the best.
It feels so otherworldly, but it feels warm at the same time. It makes you think that, you know, these people working on this film just absolutely knew what they were doing. And the problem with the infrared is that it would capture fabrics differently. So instead of changing things in post, Jacqueline West went back to the drawing board, found different fabrics that worked better with the camera. So it really was like from the ground up, everyone was doing their best. I think in the bigger categories, we're looking at picture again, partly for how much audiences love this movie and that it's already made $500 million worldwide within like a month of being out. So its trajectory is way up there. I would love to see Denis Villeneuve get nominated for something like this. Will it happen? I don't know. I mean, again, it's very early and director is, that's a race and that's not something we can just place him in already. Mm-hmm. But for the grand work that this is and what he made from it, I think he is definitely worthy of that sort of nomination.
I mean, it's also, it's hard because, and part of the reason why I wanted to ask you about director was because he didn't get nominated for Dune Part One. And that was a year where even though Dune wasn't my favorite movie of the year, should he have gotten in over Kenneth Branagh for Belfast? Absolutely. Every day of the week.
Oh, God.
So
I forgot that was why. Oh, no.
Yeah. But I'm curious, though, this year, because we just don't know what this year's slate's going to look like, but I think he has a good chance.
The other technicals, I would say, probably in sound, just again for how much is going on. Mm-hmm. And then visual effects, which if it doesn't win, I will be shocked by what else will be coming out this year. But this is just a total feat. Practical or not, it's incredible to watch.
Yeah, we're looking at potentially a lot of nominations, and it could be that big tech juggernaut again, just like the first movie was. I don't know how I'd feel about Greg Fraser again.
Not for you, not for you.
Not for me. So if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
There are so many technical categories that I want to give it to, which I think makes me want to give it to Denis even more. I think the way he tackled the material and how he made it his own and changed it for what is to come. There's also a TV series coming, which apparently we're getting a trailer for soon, so we'll see how that connects in. It's supposed to cover the Bene Gesserit and the Sisterhood, which is exciting. Maybe we'll get more character development in that part of the
He's
world.
Just going to keep promising me, you'll get it on the next one. You'll get it on the next one. I'll just be here in 10 years waiting for the character development.
But it's a world that invited us back, and I loved being in yet again. And, you know, getting a third movie seems a little ridiculous, but the fact that Denis loves it so much and wants to keep building on it and bringing us back excites me to see what he'll do next. Which Oscar would you give it?
I'm going supporting actor for Austin Butler. Let's give him his Oscar for this villainous turn. He brought so much into this performance, and I really couldn't look away. Reading the book, that was not what I expected from this character, but I think he did what he could to make this a potentially iconic role for him, and I would love to see him win his Oscar for it.
Way more so than Elvis, I will say.
I think he would have been a good winner for Elvis, but I think this, for me, is more of a career-defining role for him, oddly. Like, even though he played Elvis and was the lead in Elvis, and that was considered by some to be a breakout role, this is just so fun. Like, you can see him having so much fun and taking risks here. And I think he really understands the weirdness of Dune and of that world. And he's just brilliant in it. I love it.
Yeah, I love that pick too. Well, we'll see with Oscars in 9 months. But for now, let's get on to Smash or Pass. I think we have some repeats from last time, but again, there aren't many like main male characters in this story. So we're going off our feelings on them from this film in particular. So starting us off with Stilgar, played by Javier Bardem, the religious fanatic.
I know he's a religious fanatic, and that is problematic. However, I have to say Smash, because I think that this character, again, while he's terrifying in certain ways, and he just blindly follows, he's Javier Bardem. And I'm sticking with the answer that I gave for part one, which is Smash.
I feel like I might have smashed him in part one for how powerful he was. He definitely feels like a different character in part two. And I'm going to have to say pass.
That's the wise choice.
The beard is bearding too much in this case.
I think the beard is what makes him a Smash also. It adds to it for me.
Okay.
It'll be interesting to see if our answers change for the characters from that were exactly in both parts. But RIP to two of our hottest fallen. Duncan Idaho, played by Jason Momoa, and Duke Leto, played by the beautiful Oscar Isaac.
I mean, he's the hottest.
Yeah, he really was.
That list, this list, he would have been. So too bad there wasn't a flashback. It didn't come true.
If only. Next, we have the Baron, played by Stellan Skarsgård.
I was glad that the oil bathtub made it back into part two.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean I'm joining him in there. This is a pass.
On our last Smasher Pass, I was laughing so hard because you said that the suspensors would be fun to try out. And I said, just not with him. God.
Well, they cut him free. Can they like still repurpose them maybe after he's dead?
Maybe just with another character. This is a pass for me.
Next, we have Raban, played by Dave Bautista.
This is a hard pass for me. He's just very aggressive and not in a good way.
Absolutely. It was interesting how they made everybody bald. You know, that was a big thing with Fade, is that in the book, he has hair. And I think it was a nice way to feature the Harkonnen in making them all bald. Yeah, all of that for me didn't work at all. Seeing him bash that guy's face into the machine, I was like, oh my God, please.
Yeah.
Go away. Yeah, this is a pass.
Next we have the Emperor.
This is really for you after our conversation last week. A big pass for me.
This is a pass for me too. You joke that I love older men, but he's just very lifeless here. And that's a pass.
He really has nothing to do. He's the weakest emperor, and he's really either sitting down or huddled, shielded by his men in this movie. That's like all we see him doing. It's kind of lame. Next, we have Gurney Halleck, played by Josh Brolin.
Easy smash for me. I think this is one of Josh Brolin's best looks. He is just this strong, serious, silent type, and I have to say smash.
I would say smash. I mean, we're kind of low on smashes here. So I'll say that here. I loved how his character came back. We see him playing the guitar, and the reunion between him and Paul, I thought was pretty touching. So I'll say smash here.
Okay. A big one. Paul Atreides, played by Timothée Chalamet.
Absolutely a smash. There were certain shots of him that I was just immediately overwhelmed and turned on by. The way he kneels to one side in that cave sequence, you know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about. I hate that I know what you're talking about, but I do.
I was just like, why is this enticing? Or how did they come up with this sort of choreo? It's not even really that. But yeah, and I thought with him screaming and yelling, I was just really hot and bothered by.
This is shocking. But I'm going to say smash.
Oh my God. It's an Oscar Wilde miracle.
I'm converted. My thing with him in the first movie was, I said, like, he seems a little young. He's a lot to learn. Here, I was very convinced by his confidence, and he has a beautiful face you go to battle for. He really does.
And last but not least, I think the trickiest one we've had, Fade Rautha, played by Austin Butler.
This is not tricky at all. This is an easy smash. Number one smash of me for the list. There are a couple of moments that made me think about it. First, when he sticks his tongue out and tests that the sharpness of the knife on it. That was a lot.
That's wicked.
Also, we called Denis Villeneuve a tease in part one when Oscar Isaac as Duke Leto is sitting at the table. Mm-hmm. And we don't see anything. I think he's a bigger tease in this movie because the fact that we just get the debrief from Lady Margot about how she is basically a Bene Gesserit dominatrix mm-hmm. and seduces him. And it's very clear he loves pain, but we don't see any of that. What are we doing here? But the image of it in my mind was enough for me to say smash.
I feel like he would, like, murder you right afterwards. That would scare me more. Like, watching him kill those women when he's getting ready for the battle just for
sport.
That was
scary. I know.
That is horrifying. I wouldn't even want to come that close to him.
I would only say smash if I had Bene Gesserit powers. And I had a gum jabbar.
I mean, the shot of him when he's getting ready and they're putting paint on his face and body.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that's Austin Butler, because we didn't get that in Elvis. We haven't really seen that ever from him.
Just wait till the bike riders.
Oh, yeah.
Just wait. That whole movie. I can't tell you what happens in that movie. I truly don't remember. I just remember scenes of shots of him leaning over a pool table or leaning against a bike. That's all I remember. And Jodie Comer's accent.
Oof. Well, I mean, I really do need to say pass, but if I had sworn protection, I would say smash.
Yeah. We're operating under the idea of sworn protection.
That my life is not at stake, but...
Yes.
Yeah, I was definitely most impressed by him in this movie.
Okay, so that was our Dune Part 2 wrap-up. I have to ask you, because you said after you saw Part 1 that you left the theater high on spice. Are you still high on spice after Part 2?
I'm not still high on spice, but I remember leaving it for the first time feeling like I was levitating and that I was just floating a little bit. Yeah. Maybe not as much as Part 1, but I think it's way vaster in scope than the first one was. So I'll cherish them both for very different reasons.
Yeah. I'm glad the audiences are connecting so much with it. I mean, people are going to see this movie dozens of times. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. We didn't even talk about the popcorn bucket, but go get your popcorn bucket as long as they're still in stock.
I had my friend in Philly get me one because we were out here. So I'll be donning that somewhere in my apartment for all of time. But thank you all for listening. Feel free to rate, review, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at OscarWildPod. Also, our Patreon at patreon.com/OscarWild. We'll have more bonus content coming next season and an episode on Madame Web very soon.
I can't wait for that. Thank you all for listening. We will see you next season.